In today's podcast, I'm going to be talking with Andrew Satch. Andrew has recently released a book with Jonathan Gemmell entitled, Are You 100% Sure You Want to Be an Agnostic? Andrew and I will be talking about the difference between agnosticism and atheism, and also thinking about how we can share the gospel with our friends who might be agnostic or might have other beliefs. I think it's a very helpful, encouraging conversation, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Center for Christian Living podcast. I'm Peter Orr, and today I'm joined by Andrew Satch. Andrew serves at Grace Church at Greenwich in London as a pastor and also a tutor at the Cornhill Training Course in London as well. Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Pete. Good to see you.
I wonder if, as we start, you could just tell us a little bit about yourself, how you became a Christian and how you got involved in Christian ministry.
Yeah, well, you said a little bit about me. My cool fact about where I live is that I'm on the 0 degree longitude line. So the east-west line through the world runs through pretty much my room where I'm recording this podcast now. I became a Christian at university. I was a churchgoer before that from the age of 9 because my piano teacher was in the local church choir and suggested that I join as well. But I didn't hear the gospel at that church and I was pretty cynical about it when I was a teenager. And I met some Christians at university who shared the gospel with me. And after a long period of struggling with them, I became a Christian. Although I did discover later, I was reading the Bible one-to-one with a friend at church in London. And he asked me where I was from. And I said, oh, this town. He said, oh, my great aunt used to live there. He said she went to this awful church because she was too infirm to travel further. And she used to often argue with the vicar because he hadn't preached the gospel and she prayed for the boys in the choir. So it turned out there was actually one Christian, faithful Christian at that church who'd been praying for me.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Now, that sort of ties in to the topic of our conversation today. You've written a book with your friend Jonathan Gemmell, and the book has a wonderful title, Are You 100% Sure You Want to Be an Agnostic? Can you just give us briefly the difference between agnosticism and atheism?
Yeah, atheism is the belief that there is no God. And it's quite a dogmatic position. You know, you've got to be quite confident to say, I really think that the world is here by chance and the material world is all that there is and so on. Agnosticism just means I don't know. And I think it appeals in our culture because it just sounds much more humble. You know, I'm not saying that I'm right. I'm not saying anyone else is wrong. I haven't made up my mind. I'm on the fence. And so I think it appeals because it's humble. It seems more peaceable. You know, I'm not going to take a stand that's so dogmatic that I'm going to get into an argument with somebody else, but I'm not really that bothered about it. And I think that's actually where a lot of my friends are now. They're not vigorously against Christianity. They just can't be bothered enough to take a view one way or the other because they don't see why it matters.
So, I mean, 20 years ago, we had the rise of the new atheist with Richard Dawkins and people like that. Do you think that sort of humility maybe touches something of our culture today, which is why agnosticism is becoming more prevalent rather than that aggressive kind of atheism?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there still are the loud atheists around, but I don't think they speak for the majority. I think people are more indifferent. And in one way, that's good because you don't have hostile opposition. But on the other hand, it's quite bad because people are too apathetic to want to engage at all.
In the book, you talk about three types of agnosticism. Could you just tease out for us what those three types are and how your book addresses each type?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't an official classification. Yeah. We just made up three types. But the first kind is you don't know because you haven't checked. So in the book, John says he's agnostic about how many helium balloons it would require for his wife, Aileen, to fly. And it would be possible to find out. I mean, it's quite a simple experiment. You tie one balloon on, tie two balloons, and she's still on the ground, tie X number, and then off she goes into orbit. But because she's scared of heights, it didn't seem particularly kind to do the experiment. But there's lots of things that we don't know about, but you could check. You could do the research or you could do some reading, whatever. And I think some people are agnostic about Jesus in that way. They've just never looked at him. They've never asked the questions. And it would be possible to know, but they just don't know. And that's quite an easy agnosticism to solve. If you want to solve it, you just got to do some reading. The second kind is a more dogmatic, absolute agnosticism. Someone saying, I know that you can't know. I guess this is like the philosophical position of skepticism. But it's a bit ironic because that kind of agnostic isn't very agnostic about their own agnosticism. They're saying, I am sure that I can't be sure. And the question is, how can you be sure? To say, I know that there's no evidence for God is like saying, I know there's no treasure hidden in Leicestershire, the area in the middle of England. I mean, how could you know that? You'd have to have dug absolutely everywhere. And it turned out, you may have followed the story, that under a local car park in the middle of Leicester, it turns out that the bones of King Richard III were buried. And we only found that out a few years ago. So to know that something doesn't exist means that you checked everything and you bottomed out every philosophical question. And of course, no one has. So that sort of position is a bit silly, I think. But then that leaves, so I don't know because I haven't checked. You can't know. It's sort of incoherent philosophically. But then the third kind, I think most common kind, is I just don't really want to know. So leave me alone, Christian. You know, I'm getting on with my life and it's fine. And this one isn't so much a failure to have investigated as a, I don't want to investigate because I just fear that Christianity would suck all of the joy out of my life. So it's not about a fear that Christianity is not true. It's just a fear that Jesus isn't good for me. And I can kind of relate to that because I think that's what I was as a non-Christian at university. I just had this fear that Jesus would ruin my life. You know, if Christianity had a color, it would be gray. If you could summarize the Christian ethic in a word, it would be don't. That was my view of Christianity. One of my friends describes how surprised he was to discover that Jesus turned water into wine. And it wasn't the extraordinary science that impressed him because, you know, God could adjust the laws of chemistry if needed. He was just surprised that God wasn't instead going around the world turning all the wine into water because he just thought that God was desperately worried that people might be enjoying themselves too much and it had to be stamped out. So if that's your view of God, if you think he's just sort of anti-life, then you're going to want to avoid it. And I think a lot of people do worry about that. They think religion will ruin my life, so I better keep it at arm's length. So I'll just say I don't know as a way of keeping the Christian at bay.
Would you say your book is sort of aimed at all three types of agnosticism? Do you focus in on one?
Well, I think the second, the dogmatic agnostic, there's not much you can do with. So we say a couple of times, if you're not open to the possibility of this, if you're not willing to think about this, then it's not a game that we can play. But we're kind of aiming at the person who's not really very interested, but maybe they're interested enough to read the first page. And each time we're thinking we got to earn the right to get the reader to read the next page.
Yeah.
The chapters are short. We tried to have cliffhangers at the end of each one. And it's a bear with us. I know you're not interested yet, but you might be interested if we can get you on the hook. It's that kind of aim.
That's very, very helpful and helpful as we think about our own friends who might identify as agnostic and to think that there's more behind that than simply just, I don't know, and thinking about what motivates them. That's very helpful. One of the things you talk about is the value of the Bible's testimony and the eyewitness testimony. And you have, well, it was a fun story for me to read, but maybe it wasn't fun for you to be involved. A story about
it wasn't very fun.
Eyewitness testimony and the value of it. Do you want to just give us a flavor of that?
Well, one of the chapters begins on the 12th of May, 2013, I was arrested. And I'll tell you, discovering this without any more details has actually been the thing that's persuaded some of my friends to read the book. Because I said, I won't tell you anymore. You'll have to read for yourself. Yeah, it wasn't a very nice experience. Basically, what happened was a kind of road rage incident. I was on my bike and a guy in a van got angry with me and overtook me, blocked my path, got out of his van, wanted to beat me up, pushed me to the floor. Really, thankfully, God was very kind to me. A security guard came out of a building just opposite. And it all stopped. Otherwise, I would have been, you know, beaten up. And he called the police and the police arrived and they said, what's happened? And I said, I've been assaulted. And the guy driving the van said, no, I've been assaulted. And so they arrested both of us pending the investigation of what had actually happened. And I was released about half an hour later. And then he was eventually convicted. And the point of the chapter is just, I mean, it was my only firsthand experience of the British court system. But it was just the point on the basis of eyewitness evidence, magistrates can decide what happened enough to sentence somebody in a criminal court. You might say, oh, no, I'd have to have seen it for myself. I can't believe anything secondhand. But actually, we live in countries where the justice system, you don't want to believe something fourth or fifth hand, but secondhand's okay if you've got witnesses that. And there's all sorts of tests, aren't there? Like, did I bribe the witness? If one of the witnesses who appeared, it turns out, had a massive donation in a Swiss bank account from me, that would undermine their credibility. There's questions you can ask to check out witnesses, but eyewitnesses can be very reliable.
And the eyewitnesses we have in the New Testament, are they reliable?
Yeah, on all sorts of criteria. Like, one of the important ones, I think, is they just don't really benefit from their testimony. So it's quite a contrast with, say, a religion like Islam, where Muhammad was very successful, very wealthy, very powerful, whereas the early Christians were marginalized, persecuted. And actually, the way in which they speak about themselves in a way that is not sort of self-glorifying. So you think of Peter denying Jesus three times, and that goes into the eyewitness documents. And I guess the witness for that was Peter himself. Mm. He says that you better put that in.
Yep.
So it's not an airbrushed picture where they come out of it looking great. It's an honest picture where they come out of it looking like failures, but they just wanted to say what actually happened. And we make the point in the book that lots of the early Christians were persecuted. Some of them were killed. People do die for causes that aren't true. Mm. So if you believe in something enough, there's these awful suicide pacts you sometimes get with a cult, or people flying an aeroplane into a Manhattan tower thinking that you're going to go to paradise. And I guess they sincerely believed that this was their ticket to paradise, and it's not. It was untrue. But people definitely wouldn't give their life for something that they knew to be untrue.
Mm.
And the thing about the Christian eyewitnesses is the same people who are suffering for it are the people who are in a position to know whether it's true or not, because they were there.
Yep.
So I just think the idea that they made it up and then it cost them so much, even to the point of their own death, it doesn't make sense. Whereas if they actually saw Jesus alive after he was dead, and therefore they were really certain that he could get them through death, then their willingness to be martyred kind of does make sense. You think, okay, kill me because I know that he can raise me. I've seen the evidence of that myself. So yeah, I think they've got nothing to gain. That's the key thing. The corroboration with each other, the fact you've got different accounts that I used to think the so-called contradictions between the gospels were a problem. And an absolute contradiction would be a problem. But actually what it really is little divergences, which are exactly what you expect in multiple sources. I've got a friend who's a lawyer who did a massive public inquiry in the UK, and he interviewed hundreds of soldiers about something that had happened in the war. And he said, when all the soldiers tell you exactly the same thing, that means they've colluded. Yeah. When they have accounts that don't quite match, but they've got all the main facts in common, then you think, oh, brilliant, we've got multiple sources confirming the same things. So yeah, all sorts of things like that. There's other books that are more detailed on this topic.
Yeah.
Peter Williams' book, Can We Trust the Gospels, is just outstanding. This is just one chapter. What we're trying to do at each point is to say, don't dismiss it on this grounds. We're just saying just enough to keep you listening so that we can say a bit more. That's the idea.
Sexualization of society is not new, but the untethering of sex from all relational foundations has posed new problems. No longer is sex between a man and a woman, or even between a boyfriend and a girlfriend, and nor is it even with another person you've met through an app. Sex can now be with whomever you want, in whatever way you want, even with non-human devices. Christians may not engage in these practices, but they are still immersed in the same cultural space. Our ideas of sex and sexuality can easily be shaped and changed by the world around us. How do we engage these topics in this new cultural space? How do we cling to what God in His Word says is good for sex and sexuality? How do we respond to those who say that it is time to let go of our beliefs in the name of progress? Join us as Philip Kern, head of New Testament at Moore College, brings us back to what the Bible says about relationships, our bodies, and sexuality. Philip has been working on a book about what the New Testament says about sex and sexuality, so it will be great to hear from him and his insights on this very important topic. And now let's get back to our program.
You say a little bit about the copies of the New Testament, because sometimes that's the charge that we've just got copies of copies of copies. And how do we know that we have a record of what was originally written? You touch on that very helpfully as well.
Yeah, it's just sometimes people liken it to the game. What do you call it in Australia? Telephone.
Telephone game. Yeah, the telephone game.
Where at a birthday party, one child whispers a message to another child, whispers it to another child. And then after 20 children, the message got hilariously altered. And they say, well, look, that's what's happened. But there are actually some quite key differences between copying of New Testament manuscripts and the game of telephone. And I suppose the first one is that one person is copied by multiple other people. So rather than the message passing along just one person at a time in a line, it's branching out like a tree. So, you know, like, let's say Mark's gospel, he writes the original, and then five people say, oh, Mark, can I copy that, please? Because I want a copy of that to take to my Christian friends in Alexandria. And someone else says, oh, well, if you don't mind, I want to translate it into Latin because I want to take it across to Rome. And once it's kind of branching, and then along comes the textual critic, the scholar in the 21st century, and can access copies from all over the world, from all over this branched tree. It's basically just impossible for it to have got changed without somebody noticing. Mm. So let's say, and we give the example of a rogue scribe who decides to change Jesus' mother's name to the Virgin Amy instead of the Virgin Mary. And he just accidentally writes Amy, or deliberately, to be mischievous, writes Amy instead of Mary. Well, okay, that means that all the people who copy him are going to have the Virgin Amy, but all of the people where the manuscripts are going in other directions around the world are going to have the Virgin Mary and will immediately notice that they don't match. So you can't just secretly introduce a change without it showing up, because your change is only going to reach the geographical region where you made your change. But manuscripts are heading off in all sorts of directions around the world. So, yeah, I think it's brilliant. It's basically impossible to make a change undetected. Mm. And modern scholarly texts of the New Testament, they have all of these different manuscript variants all open to see. There's no conspiracy. Everyone can check. Mm.
But really, Andrew, can we know anything about history? Surely all history is subjective.
Just what you mean by subjective? I mean, history is recorded by people, and the people who recorded the life of Jesus, they believed in what they said. But that doesn't mean by definition that they were lying. So I sometimes give the cheeky analogy, people say you can't trust the Bible because it's written by Christians. And I said, well, you can't trust medical textbooks because they're written by doctors. I mean, doctors do believe in medical textbooks. That's why they write them. But the fact you believe in it doesn't mean that you're not telling the truth. You might be lying, but more likely you've got some reason behind wanting to say so. So, sure, the New Testament writers are biased in that sense. They want to persuade you that something's true, but only because they themselves think it's true. And I think they've got good reasons to think it's true. One of the questions I like to put to my friends is, or maybe not even a friend, maybe just someone I meet on a train or something, I say, look, I've met you for half an hour and you're already pretty sure that I'm not God. And they sort of laugh. And I say, you know, because I'm just a bloke on a train. But imagine if you met me and spent 3 years of your life with me, and at the end of it, you were absolutely certain that I was God. What would it take? What would you have had to have seen in me that made you draw such a crazy, crazy conclusion? Because this thing about Jesus' friends, right? Fishermen, ordinary people, tax collectors, and they spend 3 years with him. And then at the end of it, they're all sure he's God. Like, they must have seen something pretty convincing to persuade them of that. And I just want people to be kind of curious enough to know, well, what was that? What made them think that? And as an invitation to read the Gospels for themselves.
That's very helpful. Just stepping back a little bit, you talk about the way that some people, even if they're an agnostic, see themselves as a spiritual seeker and almost see that as a kind of virtue. Do you want to say something about how you respond or think about that attitude that people might have?
Yeah, I mean, I think we do think we're very neutral and very objective, and the Bible just disagrees with that, and Jesus doesn't think that's true. So he thinks we're hiding and that God's looking. Mm-hmm. And ever since the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, in their shame for having disobeyed God, they hide. They're ashamed of their nakedness. They try to cover themselves. I guess even the fear of being naked is a sign for the fact that we're not totally comfortable with ourselves being exposed. The exceptions would be if there's innocence, like with a child, kids don't mind being naked, or when there's intimacy, like with a partner. But with God, the innocence has gone and the intimacy has gone. And so we hide. And Jesus describes himself as one he's going looking. The Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost, he says in Luke 19. He describes himself like a shepherd who rejoices when he finds a lost sheep. I remember one British preacher saying, oh, we need to update this parable because Jesus doesn't seem to realize that we're all looking for him and that he's the one he's hiding. So maybe we need to update it to the parable of the lost shepherd. And all these sheep are going around going, do you know where that shepherd is? Oh, I'm not sure if there is a shepherd. Oh, I'm pretty objective and I've looked at all the evidence for shepherds and I can't really seem to be sure about it. And we kid ourselves that we're on the hunt for God. And God says, no, you're actually hiding from me because you're ashamed and you don't want to. Jesus talks again, doesn't he, in John 3 about anyone who does evil hates the light and doesn't want to be exposed by the light. That's Jesus' verdict on us. I certainly know it was true of me as a non-Christian. I was hiding and I wasn't really in a hurry to find out about it. And I guess that's Jesus' challenge to us. Maybe that's true of us too.
And you do have the sobering note that being an agnostic is dangerous, or remaining an agnostic is dangerous. It's not a, we kid ourselves that it's a virtue of humility, but you draw the danger in being an agnostic.
Yes. And it's because Jesus makes a diagnosis about us that says we're in mortal trouble. We've got a disease called sin and it's going to kill us. And therefore, we're using a medical analogy, I guess, because Jesus talks about people being sick. And if you're sick and you go to the doctor and they say you're sick and you need this treatment, and you go to another friend and they say, well, no, you look okay to me, Andrew. And I said, well, the doctor said I was sick. No, no, you don't want to trust that doctor. You look fine. And you've now got two opinions about your health, the person who says you're in bad health and you need treatment and the person who says you're fine. But what's the agnostic position then? Do you go, well, I just don't know. I'm not sure which person was right. Maybe I am ill or maybe I'm not ill. Okay, so are you going to take the treatment or not then? There's not a neutral option about being sick and needing treatment. Because if you just remain undecided and you don't take the treatment, that's actually the same as gambling on the fact that you're okay. And if Jesus is right and we're not okay, then we need the treatment. There's not really a neutral option when it comes to medical treatment. And I think therefore there's not really a neutral option when it comes to Jesus' diagnosis and our need to be forgiven.
It's a wonderful book. It's a very helpful book for us to read as Christians. I think it's a very helpful book for us to give to our friends. Just stepping back a little bit and thinking about us as Christians and wanting to share the gospel with our friends. It seems in the world that we live in that evangelism is getting more difficult. Any encouragement for listeners in their evangelism?
I think the biggest encouragement is God is still an evangelist, right? So it's not like God's given up drawing people to Jesus just because it's the 21st century. And it's been very difficult at other times in history too. I mean, arguably a lot more difficult. There's times in history where people have killed you for your faith. And right now people are just like, oh, I'm not that interested. And there are still people who are becoming Christians. I'm too pessimistic and I'm always surprised that people are more interested to talk about Jesus than I expected them to be. So I always sort of prejudge, oh, you won't want to know about this. And then they do want to know about it. I think just being a little bit provocative and a little bit cheeky, and that's the sort of tone we try to take in the book, but it's the tone I try to take as well with people. Make people curious. I think people are interested. I try to, and I'm not brilliant at this, but I just try to talk in the same way to my non-Christian friends as my Christian friends. So like if I'm encouraged by a sermon at church, I'll tell my next door neighbor that. I said, oh, how are you, Anne? I've had a really good morning because I've just been thinking about the resurrection of Jesus. And it's just really been encouraging to me because I've got this friend who died recently. And rather than saying, oh, I talk about resurrections with Christians and I talk about gardening with non-Christians, just try and be the same. That's my attempt.
Wonderful. Well, Andrew, thank you very much for writing the book. Thank you to Jonathan as well. And we thank you very much for your time on the podcast. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks for having me, Pete.
To benefit from more resources from the Center for Christian Living, please visit ccl.more.edu.au, where you'll find a host of resources, including past podcast episodes, videos from our live events, and articles published through the Center. We'd love for you to subscribe to our podcast and for you to leave us a review so that more people can discover our resources. On our website, we also have an opportunity for you to make a tax-deductible donation to support the ongoing work of the Center. We always benefit from receiving questions and feedback from our listeners, so if you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at ccl@more.edu.au. As always, I'd like to thank More College for its support of the Center for Christian Living, and to thank my assistant, Karen Belhards, for her work in editing and transcribing the episodes. The music for our podcast was generously provided by James West.